Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
I'm Still Here, a movie which I know is going to be particularly memorable, particularly significant in all sorts of ways. We're delighted to be able to speak to two wonderful folk who are connected and responsible for this, starting off, of course, with...
Hi, my name is Mikkel Juul Iversen. I'm the founder of Under One Sky. The film follows our work on the streets during the pandemic.
And this is one of the critical things. We'll speak to Frank in a few moments, who's also responsible for making the film. Just talk to us a little bit about what your rationale for this highly significant and really vital piece of social filmmaking was.
It was such a unique situation, and I think what many people don't realize, because they were sitting inside at the time, was that there was a human catastrophe going on the streets. So from a charity perspective, it was a matter of life and death. The people we met needed support immediately, and that's what we stepped into to deliver. And we're then just lucky that that's been captured in a wonderful documentary.
And in terms of obviously distributing the film and actually making it accessible, we're fortunate enough today to be actually looking at the screening facilities here in the School of Film, Media and Journalism at the University of Lincoln. What's the general strategy over the next few months?
So we've already had some cinema screenings. The film is still going through the festival circuit as well. The next step for us is further cinema screenings and then moving more into digital distribution, both self-distribution but also distribution on other platforms. So we're currently speaking to various parties, both within that space but also on the broadcasting side.
Let's bring in the filmmaker. He's standing to one side here and obviously sort of pausing for thought. Frank, just describe again how you got involved with this whole project.
First of all, we wanted to do something around homelessness at the beginning of the pandemic. I'd been out and saw the issue firsthand, and when a friend of mine introduced me to Mikkel, Mikkel wanted to make a promotional video for Under One Sky at that point, which we did. And just during that process, we realised that there was a much bigger opportunity there to make a really important film about homelessness.
Britain has a long history of important filmmakers. I realise you're more from the Southern Hemisphere from that point of view, but in terms of the sequence, I look at the likes of John Grierson, I look at Roberto Flaherty, of course, he was Canadian. Was that something which you have your roots in terms of obviously making a film which really can act as a mode of social change?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, my background is in film and television, but I came from a sort of a news investigative journalism background. Mm. I've always had a social conscience and like telling stories, you know, through adversity.
Yeah. And Mikkel, the message there in terms of, as you say, Under One Sky, we are all on one planet, fragile it actually is. If I was to actually ask you, what are you looking to achieve over the next year or so with respect to this film and more?
I think for me, the key message with the film is actually what we can achieve if we come together as a community. And that is both within the sphere of homelessness, but actually with all social challenges. And if we look at homelessness is the almost like a byproduct of other social challenges. So what I'm hoping that people take away from the film is actually they walk out of the film feeling inspired to go out and make their own communities better. And thankfully, we already have that audience feedback from several people. So that's what I hope people take away from it. It is set within homelessness, but this is a much bigger story, and it's a story about empowerment. Mm-hmm.
And allowing for that, in terms of the next stages, will you be looking to make another film? Will there be a follow-up? Will we see what has happened to, obviously, the narrative that we're going to be presented with today?
There's, at the moment, not a plan to do sort of a follow-up film, but uh, a group, we're very tight knit, so we're kind of looking at whether something, some other opportunities come up. And Under One Sky as an organization has many plans, so there's probably ample scope to do follow up things.
And can you just share with us, for the benefit of the listener who may not be familiar with the organization, etc., is it a bit like the Mission Impossible routine? You sort of start at the beginning and you say, right, we'll have Frank for that particular routine, we'll select this, etc. How does the team operate?
Well, we are a tiny, tiny team in terms of permanent staff. We have 2.5 people. But then over the last 4 years, we've had about 2,500 volunteers come through the door. So we, whenever an opportunity comes up, we start looking at, you know, what are all the great people and connections we have. And then we start stitching together solutions. So, we're lucky to know a lot of people and have a lot of people who are interested. And we're actually, with the future plans that we have, we're looking to find ways of allowing people to give more of the best they have to give.
Well, certainly a privilege. I'm delighted that Professor Matty Yort was able to facilitate you coming to the University of Lincoln today. Frank, any other thoughts you have on this great adventure?
I just really hope that we can do something about homelessness, really. And this is the bottom line. I think, you know, this film gives people on the streets a voice. It gives them a platform. It also adds to the our look at homelessness and social issues, like Mikhail was pointing out. So, you know, it's a very important film. And, in terms of making other ones, we probably will.
And as we frequently say, when we are featuring issues with respect to homelessness, it's something which tragically could affect anybody. I mean, nobody's actually immune to the spectre of homelessness. And that's why, particularly crazy political point here that I appreciate you might not want to comment on, but the British government actually wanting to make homelessness a crime is outrageous.
Well, yeah, I think that should be a crime. It is outrageous. It's just completely nonsensical. And I think it just shows lack of awareness around about humanity, to be honest with you, because how can you make something like that a crime? It's almost hard to comment on because it's complete nonsense.
People who listen to this and want to get in touch with Under One Sky, what's the best web address to actually go to?
So if you go to www.underonesskytogether.com, you can learn more about the organization. How to get involved. We also work with people who are remote. At the moment, we are operational in London, in Newcastle, and we're just about to set up in Edinburgh. And both Newcastle and Edinburgh, we've actually set up through universities. We also work with Durham last year. So, this is about community. Get in touch wherever you are. If you have a passion to get involved, just drop us a line.
Well, it's always a delight to welcome our next guest to the program. We were listening, of course, there to Mikkel and Frank from the Under One Sky project, something we will actually allude to as this next interview proceeds. But as I say, that special guest, the superb individual who we're delighted to welcome back, an author, a publisher, a computer programmer, a general all-round wonderful soul, born and raised in the Bronx, who actually had 12 years of Catholic education as well, which is absolutely fantastic. We, of course, welcome the fabulous James L. Hill back to the program. How are you, James?
Hey, thanks for having me back. And 12 years of Catholic education ruined my life.
Now, that could be an interesting book title. It could be an interesting book title, but maybe we'll steer away from the whole thing, because I think Pope Francis is doing a reasonable job. Anyway, let's...
Well, he's okay. I got him. He's all right.
Yeah, there you go. At least we've dealt with the controversial thing you started to start off with. James, we spoke a few weeks ago, and obviously we were focusing then on your writing. We're going to focus a bit more on the publishing side of things now, and just share with us why you decided to actually become a publisher.
Well, because it took me over 20 years to publish anything. Mm. You know, I went through the whole trying to get an agent, trying to get publishers. I went so far as to take a job delivering newspapers at night so I can get down Publishers Row and slide stuff underneath the doors to the publishers, which they promptly slid back and telling me they don't accept unsolicited material and things like that. So, you know, I tried all the normal ways and the abnormal ways of getting published, and it is just a bear. And then I was also into document processing because I'm also a computer programmer. So after years of working in document processing and everything, I found out it was pretty easy to actually put together books and everything. And I found out how I learned the ropes. Mm. And once I learned the ropes for myself, I figured, why not help other people? Because I'm out there doing book signings and things like that. And everybody's asking me, hey, how did you get your book published? How did you do that? And, you know, how can I do that? And of course, I thought it was going to be easy and I was going to make millions of dollars with Amazon and, you know, get online and, you know, people would just be, you know, lined up at my door. None of that happened. None of that's for real. It just doesn't happen.
As long as you enjoy the journey on the way, that's important. Of course, it's Rock Hill Publishing LLC, and as you said, it's not just a kind of a sort of vanity project. Basically, it's designed to basically give other folk the chance to actually see their words in print, to connect on that basis. And all publishing companies, even Barnes and Noble and Bloomsbury, had to start off small back in the day. So who knows what future years could develop, James?
Yeah, I mean, at one point, I was doing like one or two because it was me and my editor. So, you know, she was editing me and I was publishing her. And it was, you know, quite the symbiotic relationship there. And so it worked out well. And let me say hello to Anna because she's been just sitting there very quietly. And no one acknowledged her since we came on.
Well, you see, always gracious, James. That's what we appreciate about you. And I was just actually about to bring in our ace correspondent from Bucharest. Recently, actually, successfully completed her first ever solo on-location report with an event at the Lincoln International Business School, in which she was actually very much focused on how AI should be embraced and fully actually brought in as part of her whole experience. And as a computer programmer, James, obviously you're well based to actually talk about not only the possible benefits, but also the challenges of AI. So I don't know if Anna, if that opens up your first question, but over to you, please.
Hi, Alex. Thank you. Actually, it does, because after seeing that you worked in programming for so many years and you're also a writer, I was actually wondering, taking into account how AI has developed in the last few years and that now they say that it can also have emotions of some kind, do you think there would be possible for AI to write original love stories and use emotions on its own, other than taking them from other writers and giving us views from other people?
I got to remind everybody that machines are still machines, and there's somebody behind the machine pushing the buttons. So far, AI had come a long way, but we still have to feed in the information. And we still have to generate the algorithms that it works upon. So as machine learning becomes more and more advanced, and believe me, I'm not actually sure how any of this works, but as these algorithms get more advanced, yeah, I think it will be able to have an emotional response to something. It's sort of like teaching children. You know, children are a blank slate. And so if you consider the AI like a child, at some point that child realizes what it wants and what it knows. And for children, it comes very early. They always know what they want. But so at that point, at some point, if we can actually mimic the way, and people don't know the way the brain works now, so that's the problem. We really don't know how memory and the thought processes and the chemistry of the brain actually works. Like, we know what parts of the brain does what to some extent, but we don't know exactly how it does it. And so to create an AI, an artificial intelligence, an artificial brain that will mimic or the great fear is that it's going to surpass us. that's the part that we have to get down. You know, feeding it information and having it parrot it back to us, that's the easy part. The getting the idea of creation is the hard part. And I have an author, John Ford, who wrote a very good book. It's called Dominion. And that's a lot about what that book is. And he talks about it, and he talked about how the brain works and all that kind of stuff in a nice sci-fi story that blew me away. He was one of the first authors, second author, that I actually published, because I read his story and it was amazing. It's called Dominion. So he's on our website, Rock Hill Publishing. He's one of our authors. And he works in weather. I don't know if he's a meteorologist, but he works in the weather. But he wrote this book that has a lot to do with AI and emergent, the emergent technology and how the brain actually works, things like that.
It is a very important and significant aspect. I just have to, unfortunately, say, Anna, we will need to ask you to unmute every so often, because I noticed that there's a slight technical AI glitch that when your microphone was actually open, for some reason, we were getting some sort of howl around between James and myself. So I had to mute you in betwixt of James's response there. But don't worry, I think all will be well in terms of the system. Just briefly, James, going back to that dystopian or potentially dystopian scenario of AI and so on, ties in very nicely with a movie I was privileged to see yesterday, which was basically called I'm Still Here. And I also was privileged to actually meet the filmmaker and the producer behind it as well. It was about London in lockdown, but specifically the homeless in London, and how, in essence, they were having to cope when everything else was shut down due to COVID-19. And how they could only cope through literally the kindness of strangers. I found it emotionally quite overwhelming, and I wish the crew huge success in terms of promoting this at film festivals and various other areas. My question for you, James, is obviously we're post-pandemic now, but there's still an awful lot of people for whom this digital revolution might as well be as far away from them as Mars is from us, because either they don't have the technical skills, or they don't have the financial skills, or life has thrown them a curveball and they've ended up homeless and they're problematic from that sort of point of view, or seen as problematic. Any thoughts on that? And is the situation the same in Virginia Beach, in New York, in terms of that? Or is it worse? Is it better? And are we in danger of actually getting this two-tier society? So it's a fairly heavy question, I admit that, James, but I'm sure you could actually answer it.
The pandemic actually showed how divided and what a big split there is between education, money, you know, finances, because when they shut down all the schools here, you know, we shut down everything at one point. And the problem was people wouldn't do it for 2 weeks. So we wound up shut down for a year. If they would have just taken the government's suggestion, shut everything down for 2 weeks, let the virus die out, and then we could have reopened. But when you have half the people doing it and the other half of the people not doing it, saying, I don't have to do it because I have my freedoms, and you can't tell me what to do and all that kind of stuff, the thing spread and kept going. And then the domino effects happened, and we wound up having to shut down everything for a lot longer. And what happened was we found out that school systems were not ready. So when kids are stuck at home and they don't have computers, or they don't have the network, which was even worse problem, because not every place, you would think America is this great land of opportunity and wealth and everything, but there are pockets of wealth and pockets of poverty, like every place else. And there's, and even in some of the wealthier places, they didn't have the connectivity to get to the internet to have all these students go online and stuff like that. And so that's one of the things that we then realize our infrastructure, which everybody was thinking roads and bridges, stretches much further than that. And it's internet and it's communications and it's how people were so isolated because of the fact that we did not have this great network that everybody just assumed existed. And it doesn't. And you have to build that stuff out. And so when people came out of lockdown, some people went a bit crazy because it was a little stir crazy from being locked up, you know. And other people said, hey, you know, we need to really get this thing together. We really need it. It showed it showed how bad off the world actually is, and how everybody thinks the world is this wonderful place and technology is all this and all that, and you know, we have satellites and everything, and then you find out you pull the plug on one thing and the whole damn thing stops and goes down the drain. And it's very hard to get it back up again once you pull the plug or once, you know, the line's been severed. And so when you say about a dystopian society, we're always in a dystopian society. One thing I've learned from writing is that every age sees itself as the end time. And they're always forecasting doom and gloom because they cannot see what's coming. And all they do see what's coming is destruction. And so then you have your Einsteins and your Leonardos and these other people who can actually see beyond the veil. Well, I wouldn't put myself there. I'll let you put me there. That's good.
I mean, so it is a serious point. James, as a publisher, as an author, you clearly have an artistic commitment. There's a line there. Do you feel that it is the role of the imagineers, if we might say, the wordsmiths, the crafters of not just high adventures, and we know you do great high adventure novels, both from a crime fiction point of view and from a fantasy point of view, etc. Do you feel that actually, in some small way, that can actually help improve the lot of humanity? And is that an important vocation, as I said, to actually have? Because, you know, it is, I often feel within broadcasting, we have a responsibility. We're privileged, even if we're using Zoom on this basis, to actually have a responsibility for the words that we're putting out there somehow. And I mean, appreciate it. It's a fairly philosophical line, but the movie itself, as I say, if you do get a chance to see it, Under One Sky, it does make you think very, very deeply about some of these kind of issues.
I do believe that it's every writer's job and responsibility to bring the world forward, to reflect the world as you see it. And of course, we're all going to see it differently, you know. And poets, writers, artists, that's their job. Their job is to present the world as we see it to the rest of the world so that they can see it. And the advances that the world goes through are on the backs of our writers and our artists and our poets and our musicians. They're the ones who inspire the engineers and the scientists to say, oh, that's a good idea. I bet you I can do it. You know how many people invented things thanks to Star Trek, the communicators, Bluetooth, all that kind of stuff? Came out of the idea of, that's a really good idea that Roddenberry had. And they set out to build it because they see it. They set out to do the space program because of the people of the 18 and 1900s who said, we can get to the moon and we can do this. And, you know, they had a little bit of knowledge about how things will work. And they said, well, if we did that, why can't we make it to the moon? And, you know, 100 years later or so, people are walking on the moon.
What the mind can conceive, humanity can achieve, including hopefully having a clean feed from Anna, who's, as you say, been consistently waiting patiently now. Anna, if you would like to unmute yourself and actually throw in any other questions you'd like for James.
I have hundreds of questions, to be honest, and I don't know which one to ask first, because I saw that you're writing different types of stories. You're writing crime, love, sci-fi. I was wondering, which type is your favorite? And when you cannot sleep at night, do you ever find yourself writing short stories that you never publish, but you love them more than other stories that you published?
My favorite story to write, I would probably say, is science fiction, although and I write more short story science fiction than novel length science fiction. I got to get back to writing some novels. They're banging around inside my head waiting for their opportunity. And yeah, I write stuff that I know I'm never going to publish. It's just an idea that comes out, and sometimes it's not even a fully developed idea. It just, let me write this down and Once I get that down, it's like, okay, maybe I'll get back to that one day. But, you know, it's there. It's there on the computer now. So, and it used to be in the notebook. You know, I used to write things in the notebook. But the problem with that is I can't read my own handwriting. So I look at this stuff months later and I'm like, what was I writing? What was that word supposed to be? So yeah, practice penmanship. If anybody's out there, practice penmanship, because when the computers go dead, we're gonna have to go back to writing.
And I actually had one more question that I always love asking writers. If there you would be able to bring to life one of your characters, who would that be and why?
Okay.
From your books, obviously.
Yes. I was going to say, I would bring Mojo to life. And he's a very dangerous character. And I think you asked me this one time before, and I had picked somebody else. But, you know, every now and then, you know, you think about who would you bring. Mojo's a very interesting character. I would stay on his good side, but he's a very interesting and very complex person. And therefore, and his morals are built out of a 12-year Catholic education. So his morals are there, well-developed, but also being a product of his environment and growing up in a world of criminality and where you have to fight to survive. I grew up in the South Bronx, so I know quite a bit about, you know, fighting to survive. Even when you're friends with somebody during the day because you're in school together, and once you leave school, they're your sworn enemy because they're in another gang. And you live by those rules. So we can't tell anybody that we know each other and that we hang out together and we have these interests and these ideas that we have developed in school together. But then when we get outside, they're on their side of the fence and I'm on my side of the fence. And that's the way life is. And we have to live by those rules and those codes. And Morris lived by that life. He lived that code. And so to bring him to life would be an interesting person to have, to know, hang out with.
Interesting to see how it's developing. Now, James, in about 16 hours from now, both American time and UK time, Anna will be making her debut on location at her first ever science fiction convention. So my question really for you is, have you been to any of these science fiction conventions before, either as a writer or a publisher or a crime writers convention? And if so, have you any advice for Anna, who will be making her debut at this particular production on the seaside resort of Scarborough, where we do like to geek beside the seaside?
My suggestion would be to send me a ticket. I'll be there. But I've been to some Comic-Cons. I've been to some crime conventions. And so I haven't been to any sci-fi ones yet. But one thing is, absorb it all. Live in the moment. Just gather it all in, because it's going to be amazing and you're going to want to experience everything. And I don't know what you're going to be doing there. Are you going to be presenting? Are you going to be speaking?
It'll be a reporting post, basically, a kind of on-location audio postcard. And we'll make sure, James, that we give you at least two name checks as we wander around speaking to authors and writers and coordinators. So even though we don't sadly have the Siren Radio jet plane that we can actually provide for you to actually fly you across the Atlantic, a la David Frost back in the day, but we will ensure that you're actually there with us in spirit.
Thank you. And like I said, absorb it all, since you're going to be, find the people that you want to speak to the most. Find them first. And then, you know, make sure you get those people down, because as things go on, it's going to be so busy, you're going to miss out on some of the things you really want to do and people you really want to talk to. So get your list together before you go and, you know, seek those people out first, or definitely, you know, make time to get them in. Then just enjoy yourself. Life is about enjoyment.
And so positive. Now let's go back to the James L. Hill biography, if we may, of course, because as we said, you spent your adolescent years in Fort Apache in the South Bronx, 41st Precinct, during the 1960s, a time where you needed a gang to go to the store, which I thought was interesting, as you've already referred to. You were raised on blues, soul, and rock and roll, which gave you the heart of a flower child, and educated by the turmoil of Vietnam, civil rights, the sexual revolution, all of which produced a gladiator. We look back now, obviously, on the 60s, and of course, the cliched line is, if you can remember the 60s, you weren't really there. Is it a situation that we see, are we repeating those in some ways? Do we see similar kind of notions to politically, political unrest and so on? Or is it a case of what we had in that short but nevertheless fondly remembered decade was a series of huge advances but huge contradictions? We obviously followed the JF Kennedy line to getting humanity on the moon. Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Michael Collins. Obviously, Michael never got to the moon, which I always thought was a bit tough, but still, you know, he did circle going around. We had, as you said, the onset of color television. We had the advent of new fantastic lines and tropes such as Star Trek and so on. We had the Age of Aquarius. We had the revolution. We had the music of the Beatles. We had the Beach Boys. We had, you know, Tamla Motown coming to light. We had all of this. And yet the flip side, we've got the assassination of Kennedy, the assassination of Martin Luther King, the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. We have war in Vietnam, which, look back, is seen as a historical misstep by both Lyndon Johnson, Kennedy, and Nixon, and the administrations in terms of the sequence. And we have all this going together. I mean, is it a case of wow, or is it a case of, well, okay, we survived it, and we're going to survive the 20s as well?
In a lot of ways, we're redoing the same thing we did in the 60s. And in the 60s, I would say it was a little bit more newer because we had television, which was opening up the world to a lot of places. I always say the Vietnam War ended because of TV. Because they sent reporters in with the troops, and then you actually got to see what war was like in your home and in your house. And people say, oh my God, that's what we do in war? It's not that it was anything different than what we did in World War II or Korea or any of the other wars before that. It's just that it was now broadcast to the entire world, and you got to see it live and in color, as they used to say. And it was terrifying. And people were like, I don't want to be part of that. And so we grew up in the television age. Now people are growing up in the internet age. And they're growing up in the TikTok world, and where everybody in an instant learns about everything all around the world. And we're growing up in the misinformation age, where anybody could say anything and people believe it because there's nobody to. Gotcha. It used to be, at least in the 60s and the 70s, there was a little bit of a buffer between what people were showing. You still had somebody sitting there saying yes or no. You know, don't put that out. Fact check it. Find out if it's true before we say it. Now, people want to be the first one to say it. So they don't care if it's true or not. They just want to be the first person out there. And that's a very dangerous thing because there are very many people in this world who has an agenda that they are willing to push regardless of the truth. And that's always been the way world is. We always have people who will do whatever they want to get ahead, to push their agenda, right or wrong. And everybody has their own belief of what's right and wrong. Some of it is universal, some of it is not. And so when you don't have that, when you don't have that time break and say, let's look into this before we go forward, you find yourself running off the cliff and you're taking everybody with you, but they're all following you because they think you know what you're talking about. After all, here you are on my computer screen telling me this. And so we're in the worst age, and it grew out of the age of live and in color. And what was it, Andy Warhol? So everybody will have their 15 minutes of fame. Well, now it's 15 seconds. And it's truly everybody and anybody. Anybody with a phone nowadays can capture that 15 seconds on their phone and broadcast it to the world. And you see that 15 seconds, but that's not the entire story. That's only the story that person wants you to see. You didn't see what happens before it. You don't see what happens after it. You only see 15 seconds of something happening. And everybody formed an opinion of what they thought happened without any background, without anybody filling you in with any of the real information that goes around it. And that's a very dangerous world to live in.
Yeah, one wonders if the Washington Post and Woodward and Bernstein would have actually necessarily had the success covering Watergate, and indeed before them, the release of the papers
the
that suggested
papers.
The Pentagon papers, etc. Given the current scenario of what has been referred to, I think, very interestingly, as the post-truth society. However, that's another time for another issue. Anna, any other questions for yourself?
Yes. While you were talking, I was also looking at the signs that are on your wall, and they made me think. Do you have any? Yes, those ones. Do you have any upcoming projects that you can share with us right now?
Yes, I am working on a horror story, a horror novel, and because I like history, history was one of my favorite subjects in school. I was pretty bad at it because I didn't remember dates and everything, but it was always very interesting to me. And so I'm working on a horror story, a paranormal horror story about vampires in the post-Napoleonic era. So it takes place right after the Napoleonic Wars in Germany.
So the 19th century, circa 1820 or thereabouts?
Yeah, I think it's, what, 1860s or No, before that, right. Probably 1820s or so.
Yeah, I was thinking the 1860s, you slap bang in the middle of the American Civil War, basically. I mean, there'd be probably vampires around then as well. But, you know, 1861 to 1865, not a good time if you're actually in any part of the States, really, I would have thought.
Yeah, but this takes place in Germany. And it's the Kingdom of Hanover, which is ruled by an English king. You know, I think it's King George. Y'all probably know this better than I do.
Well, we hadn't entered the Victorian era, so I think we're looking at King George. If it was George III, of course, he was also responsible for effectively saying nothing much happens today when the American War of Revolution started. So I'm never quite sure about that. And as we always like to say for American folk, it's the madness of King George III, not, as one or two people said, so what happened to the madness of King George episode 1 and 2, as opposed to the madness of King George 3? It's an old one, but it was one that was worthwhile noting. This weekend, of course, it's the London Marathon, and we'll be speaking up next with Dr. Zoe Williams, who'll be talking about the importance of monitoring our heart rates and using technology, specifically Garmin watches, to actually check our sort of health, etc. Do you have any health regimes, James, that you do? Are you a secret jogger? Are you a keen tennis player? Are you a weightlifter? Or is it just a case of I get enough exercise pounding the keyboard? Thank you very much.
Well, I used to do all those things except for weightlifting. I used to be a runner in school, and, you know, after school I ran for a while and kept that up. And then I was playing tennis, you know, for a while, so I kept that up for a while. I got weights upstairs in my upstairs room that I go and work out on every, like, 6 months. You know, 10 minutes every 6 months, that's good enough to keep me down.
You don't overdo these things after all,
no,
really.
No, I specialize in the 16 and 12 ounce lift, you know.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, intriguing, because if you have the weights upstairs, of course, I would have thought that's dangerous, because surely if you drop them, they could actually fall through the ceiling. So maybe sort of change it to a downstairs room. But,
yeah. Well, it's a machine. So I drop them, it's just a machine. I don't do free weight because they did fall on me one time when I'm sitting there, you know, and you go,
You needed to have somebody spotting you. That's the key thing, to work that whole process. Health and safety issue, clearly.
So back to the gym for me. Yeah. Boating is another fun thing. Fishing is a really good exercise. People don't realize how much exercise you get in fishing. You know, you're out there casting your line, sitting there, drinking a beer, reel it in, cast your line, you know.
I believe angling is still probably one of the most popular participant sports in the United Kingdom. So that's the key thing on that basis. It actually beats soccer/football and other sort of attended sports as a participant sport. Angling is the way forward. But there we are. Almost back to that Catholic education course, becoming fishers of men, really. That's where it all started in so many ways, the spreading the word and the gospel. So an interesting line. James, how can people actually follow you through the various social media? Or is it simply a case of forget all that social media material, simply go to rockhillpublishing.com and you'll be able to access my podcast and my interview with Formidable Men magazine, or perhaps I'm very tempted to say Formidable Men magazine.
Yes, you can go to Rock Hill Publishing and find me. I'm also on Facebook. You can find me there, Instagram. And I don't really do much on Twitter or X. I pretty much just read all the crazy stuff people say out there without posting anything because...
It's a scary world. Those keyboard warriors with their strange and bizarre ways of going on. It's best to just take a hard no on that, or a hard turn in some way, shape, or form.
It had gone down so much since, what's his name, bought it, you know?
Elon Musk,
yes. Now, what a way to lose $40 billion.
And one wonders actually what that $40 billion could have actually done for the disenfranchised digital divides and indeed the homelessness of society. But that's another line for another story and another issue. We're at the two question stage, James, and I think you pretty much know what they are, but Anna's going to ask you the first one. So Anna, over to you, please.
James, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
I have had a wonderful Zoomer with you today. And I am so pleased to be here with you again.
Well, again, it's fantastic connecting with you yourself, as we said at the start, James. So can we take it so that you will be able to join us again in the not too distant future and become a regular? I was going to say, it's not Venice Beach, of course, it's Virginia Beach. Again, Virginia, I was getting the location of you wrong by several thousand miles there.
Several
basically.
Thousand miles, yes. Wrong coast.
Exactly. It's East Coast as opposed to West Coast. So very important from that point of view. So, James, will you be kind enough to return?
I shall. And you can invite me into your castle the next time, with the permanent rainbow.
Exactly. Well, you've got to actually have those. Because how would the meteorologists, who are kind of working at being futurologists and dealing with AI, how can they actually get the rain to actually fall in Dubai in acceptable counts, or indeed whatever they're actually working on? Still, controlling the weather, that's a whole other issue, which I'm sure we'll be looking at. James L. Hill, a publisher and writer extraordinaire and computer programmer, of course. Huge thanks. Also thanks to Anna Koshkinov. And as promised, up next, Dr. Zoe Williams.
Without siren radio, turn up everyone, save a siren sound. Siren radio. From Lincoln to Miami, Paris to LA, our global community wants to hear it play. Students participate, keep on keeping up, keep on keeping up, keep on keeping up, keep on keeping up,
safe siren radio. Heart rate, heartbeat, London marathons, oh, it's so exciting. And indeed, our heartbeats can be all over the place just for the thought of a London marathon. Certainly, I'm not really a marathon runner. I've always felt that the potential arthritis of the knees that could be caused is well worth stepping away from that particular form of exercise. However, somebody who certainly can give us details with respect to our heart rate variability, why it's important to actually maintain good heart health, is, of course, the legendary Dr. Zoe Williams. How are you, Zoe?
Oh, thank you. I'm great, Alex. Thanks. How are you?
It's always great to connect with your good self, Zoe. I feel as though it kind of is like an infusion of energy every time we speak. Great stuff. But let's talk a little bit about this whole notion of heart rate And indeed, heart rate variability, because obviously that ba-dum, 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 ba-dum that we sort of take when we take our pulse rate, etc., can go up, can go down, and there is an optimum level, of course.
Yes. So I think the term heart rate variability, it's heart rate variability status is something that's getting more and more popular. So I'll explain to you what it is, because a lot of people don't know. So research from Garmin found that just under half of people don't really understand what it is. So our heart rate is how many beats per minute. So what's deemed normal is between 60 and 100 beats per minute. But our heart rate variability actually describes the variation in time between each heartbeat. So say, for example, your heart rate is 60 beats per minute. You won't have one beat every second on the second. There is some variability within that. And why it's important and why it's helpful is that if your body's under stress, if you're in your fight and flight stress response, your heart rate tends to be higher, but your heart rate variability tends to be lower. So there's less variation between beats. And that's because your heart rate is being driven by the stress response. However, if you're in your chilled out, rest and digest, relaxation mode, which is what we want to be in most of the time, your heart rate tends to be lower and the heart rate variability tends to be higher. And that's because the heart rate is being influenced all the time by little things like, you know, if somebody makes you laugh, or if you eat something, or those tiny differences. And why that's helpful is that if we are monitoring our heart rate variability, it can indicate to us our resilience, how stressed we are. And it responds to things like if you had a good night's sleep, obviously emotional stress, regular exercise, healthy food. So it's another variable that we can monitor, especially if we have a smartwatch, which are very popular actually with runners. Who will all be wearing them, I'm sure you'll see this weekend for the London Marathon. So yes, talking about heart rate variability, it sounds a bit complicated, but if you have a smartwatch, it does all the analytics for you and it tells you what you need to do, essentially.
Well, I've certainly been seeing runners around Lincoln actually checking their wristwatches, or their smartwatches, I should say, in terms of the aspect of this. I mean, that technology of Garmin that they've introduced, is it a 24/7 technology that we actually monitor it even when we're looking to get our circadian rhythm sorted out and get some sleep in as well?
Yeah, definitely. So yes, like you say, runners will be checking their distances and their times and maybe monitoring even their route on the GPS. But yeah, it's to be worn 24/7 because it's looking at what's happening during sleep and what's happening during the day. So it gives you feedback on how you slept, the quality of your sleep, you know, even how much time you spent in the different phases of sleep. The Garmin has this really, my favorite feature on it, something called the body battery. And what that does, because some people don't want to look at all the data and the numbers and the graphs, and some people do, but some people just want it to be simplified. So it gives you this one metric, your body battery, where it takes everything into consideration, such as how much exercise you've done, how well you slept, what your heart rate variability is, how stressed you are. And it gives you a number, and you tend to see that number declining as your battery decharges over the course of the day. If you have a nap, it goes up a bit, or sometimes if you do something really restorative like yoga, it can go up a bit. And then typically when you sleep, it charges back up again. So you can see, especially if you're a runner, you can sort of see on which days you might be better equipped to do those really challenging training runs, and in which days you just need to ease off a little bit and do something more restorative. But even just in general life, if you're not a runner, having that information, having those metrics can help guide you when it comes towards having a healthier lifestyle.
You see, I tend to be more of a walker and probably the occasional game of tennis, but that's by the by. 60% of British folk are claiming that they're planning to be more active this year. Of course, whether they actually put those plans into motion is another issue, but that's a significant number of us who are trying to actually say, okay, we need to get fit and get active.
Yeah, and I think if you ask people, generally, people want to be more active. We all want to be healthy, don't we? And we know that actually exercise, when we do it, makes us feel great. And I think this is the London Marathon, and the fact that 50,000 runners will be doing that this weekend. It will be televised. Loads of people will travel to London, or if they live in London, will go out and support people. And it's a really good motivator. It really inspires people to want to run a marathon, want to run a half marathon, or even just to get out and do some walking or whatever. So I think a lot of people after this weekend will be feeling very inspired to go and get active. So I encourage them, say, do it. As long as you are starting off from a place that feels comfortable and building up gradually, then it's a safe thing to do. It's a brilliant thing to do for your health. And wearing, and some, for some people, a wearable can give a lot of confidence. You can actually have a coach on your wrist guiding you, telling you what to do, setting out a plan for you. The Couch to 5K, I always recommend that as a fantastic NHS app that people can use. And Parkrun, again, Parkrun's a great initiative that's available in local parks across the UK and in fact across the world, where at the weekend you can join up with people from your local community. You can run, walk or jog a 5 kilometre distance, or even if you don't want to do it, you can participate, volunteer to be a steward, or even just go out and cheer people on. So yeah, everybody can get involved one way or another.
There are so many possibilities. Of course, we still haven't reached the stage, as you know, Zoe, where I think we need to have an avatar of Dr. Zoe Williams as that additional life coach to kind of provide us with some sensibilities. Just briefly, tell us the signs of an unhealthy heart. I mean, I suspect it might well be the usual suspects of shortness of breath and various other elements. But if people are a little bit worried and they think, you know, rather than do the marathon tomorrow or Sunday or whatever, they just need to sort of be maybe aware of this and go for a checkup.
Yeah, I think the key thing about the heart is that often there aren't any symptoms or any signs that your heart is not healthy. And that's why it's really important to regularly get it checked. So anyone over the age of 40 is eligible for a free NHS health check, where your blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes, all these things will be checked. So if anybody's missed out on that, please do book in for it. If you've got any concerns about your blood pressure, the only way to know if your blood pressure is raised is to get it checked. You can get it checked at your high street pharmacy, supermarket pharmacies. You can buy a blood pressure machine yourself if you want. So keep an eye on your blood pressure. But the signs, if there was something, you know, going on with your heart, yes. Shortness of breath, obviously pain in the chest, pain in the arms, pain in the neck or the back. But often it's a inability to be able to do the exercise you used to do. So, you know, just feeling like it's really difficult to climb up the stairs or walk up a hill. It could be a sign, obviously, of low fitness. But if that seems unusual to you, then definitely get your heart checked out. People tend to think of a heart attack as being something that affects men. Well, actually, it affects women too. And people tend to think of it as something that causes this severe, crushing central chest pain. But the signs and symptoms in reality can be much more subtle than that. So anything that doesn't feel quite right, always just get it checked out when it comes to your heart.
Are you a keen marathon runner yourself, Zoe? Is it a case of, yes, I just can't wait to do my Forrest Gump routines?
I would absolutely love to say yes, but no, I'm not. I'm definitely somebody who is built for speed rather than distance. I have done 2 half marathons in the past, and I found that really, really, really challenging. But I'm sure I will do a marathon one day, just not this weekend.
Yeah, no. I think you're very wise on that one, Zoe. I mean, we appreciate the whole side of things. Okay, where can people go to find out further details? You mentioned, obviously, the NHS app that's online. What about Garmin research? Any details? How can people follow your good self on the socials?
Yeah. So, well, NHS website is a really good place to find out more about what is a normal heart rate, about blood pressure, and what you can do about that. The Garmin website, which is garmin.com, they have a whole section on there about health science. If you want to know more about the heart rate variability and the various different features on the Garmin watches that can support you with your health, check that out. If you want to follow me, the best place is Instagram at Dr. Zoe Williams. And yeah, I don't think there's anything else tell you.
I think that covers everything, as we knew it would, being a consummate professional that you are, Dr. Zoe Williams, GP extraordinaire and ace mediumatic. Huge thanks. Take care and keep on keeping on.
Thank you so much, Alex.